Stanley Tukey Williams has been a death row inmate at San Quentin State Prison since 1981. In the early 70s, he, along with Raymond Lee Washington, founded the Crips in South Central Los Angeles. In 1981, he was found guilty of killing four people during two robberies. He has always maintained his innocence of these crimes. Mr. Williams has educated young people about the dangers of gangs and gang violence through books and through his internet education program. For this work, he has been nominated 5 times for a Nobel Peace Prize and 4 times for the Nobel Prize in Literature. I'm joined on the phone today by Barbara Becknell. She is his editor and his advocate, and she is now a death penalty, anti-death penalty activist. Barbara Becknell met Williams in 1993 while researching her book America's Other Civil War, The History of the Crips and Bloods. During her interviews with Mr. Williams, Ms. Becknell learned of his commitment to putting an end to the violent legacy that had begun with the formation of the Crips, and in 1996 they collaborated on an 8-book series, Tukey Speaks Out, Against Gang Violence. I'm very pleased to be joined by Barbara today. Hello, Barbara.
Hello, how are you? Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks so much for taking the time to be here today. So, can you tell us the most recent news? What's going on with Stanley's case? I heard the U.S. Supreme Court on October 11th, 2005, ruled against Tukey on his final appeal and set his execution date for December 13th. Can you fill us in on this?
Yes. The U.S. Supreme Court did rule against him last week on the 11th, and then once that was done, the state was able to take the next step and decide on an execution date. And he got December the 13th. There was another gentleman on death row who was denied by the Supreme Court that day as well. He's been given an execution date in February of next year. And then another gentleman who was denied the week before, he was given an execution date in January. So interestingly enough, there is obviously on the part of the state of California a desire to kill to kill Stan as quickly as is possible. And I believe there's some racism involved in that as well. Stan is the only black death row inmate at the moment who is up for execution. Now, but the issues, but the issues in his case also have to deal with racism, and it's quite was a shameful day in the history of American jurisprudence last week when the Supreme Court ruled against him. Because here's what happened in Stan's case. Stan had a white prosecutor who had a pattern and practice of, first of all, only targeting low-income black or low-income Latino men to prosecute for murder. He did not like to prosecute white men for murder. That's for starters. The second thing he would do is move that low-income black or Latino man from the downtown Los Angeles court, which has always had a pretty diverse ethnic pool of jurors, and move that person to a blue-collar white community some miles away that where, in fact, there were only 3 African-Americans in the entire jury pool of almost 100 jurors. And then what this guy would do is kick the African-Americans off of the jury in the case of an African-American defendant. And so he kicked 3 African-Americans off of Stan's jury. But then that wasn't enough. During his closing arguments, he then turned to the jury and said, when you look at the defendant, you should consider yourself visiting the San Diego Zoo. And he went on to describe Stan as being like a tiger behind the bars in the San Diego Zoo. And then he also insulted the entire black community of Los Angeles by saying that community was, quote, the equivalent to the natural habitat, close quote, of a wild of the habitat of a wild animal in the jungle. And on October the 11th, the U.S. Supreme Court said that all was okay for a prosecutor, why a prosecutor to do that. And what people don't realize, because the mainstream media is really not covering this aspect of that ruling, and that is that ruling not only condemned one man, Stanley Tookie Williams, to death, it also stripped the rights away from all minorities in this country to have a fair trial, because when the Supreme Court rules or lets stand a ruling, that then becomes the law of the land. So they are saying now it is okay for race to play a role in the selection of jurors, and that minority jurors can, in fact, be kicked off of juries based on race, and that white prosecutors can use animal jungle metaphors in their closing arguments, having kicked the African Americans or the Latinos off of the jury. So it's a shameful shame. It was a shameful, shameful day.
In fact, this very same prosecutor has been censored twice by the California State Supreme Court for equally discriminatory behavior.
That's absolutely right. In fact, the prior to getting to the U.S. Supreme Court, his case went before the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals, and he had an unprecedented number of judges who disagreed with the majority to deny him relief, and there were 9 judges that dissented, and that's like unheard of. You're lucky if you get 2 or 3 judges to disagree with their colleagues. But there were 9 judges who disagreed, and they wrote a 20-something page dissent, and in it they referred to this prosecutor, and they literally said that his tactics in the courtroom were, one, racist, and that they were, quote, reprehensible and unconstitutional, close quote, and went on to say if this ruling was allowed to stand, which in fact it did, was allowed to stand by the U.S. Supreme Court, but they didn't know that then. But they said if this ruling was allowed to stand, it would mean that any prosecutor in the land who was inclined to discriminate, he would now be able, he or she, to do so with impunity. And they did refer to the 2 times the California State Supreme Court admonished this prosecutor for these racist tactics, and in fact, they reversed the guilty verdict and the death penalty verdict in those cases as a consequence. So this guy had a proven history of being a racist, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, "No problem, that's okay." As of October the 11th.
They weren't concerned about the fact that members of the California State Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had stated and had admonished this prosecutor and had stated that he unconstitutionally struck black prospective jurors and that he behaved in a racist manner. They weren't concerned about this?
Apparently not. They ruled to allow, they denied Stan the right to challenge it. So, you know, where what was that? There's no other explanation. If you have to assume that under the new Roberts Court, because here's another piece of it, they were supposed to rule on Stan's case the week before they did, but the 8 judges decided to wait an extra week and allow Roberts to get sworn in, so that it was now 9 judges, and to allow him to provide his input. So once again, you have to say this is, and so this is one of the first rulings of the Supreme Court under the new Chief Justice Roberts. Mm-hmm. And this was one heck of a first ruling out of the box, because essentially under the Roberts Court, he has given us a clear and compelling message, and that message is the Roberts Court does not give a damn about minorities in this country.
So the U.S. Supreme Court when ruling against this appeal, did they give a reason? Did they?
No.
No.
Nothing.
Okay. And is just, this? Go ahead.
Nothing. They just said cert. It's called cert petition denied. That's it.
And is
no
this,
explanation.
Is this his final appeal? That's what I've heard. Is that true, that this is his final appeal?
Well, probably, in this sense. You can't, there's no court higher than the Supreme Court, so if they turn you down, you can't go to a higher court to challenge them. But what his attorneys are going to do is file a federal habeas petition at the lower court, that same Ninth Circuit that had the nine judges' dissent. They're going to file a habeas petition with new evidence that speaks to Stan's innocence. So they are going to attempt to get the Ninth Circuit to consider this new evidence of innocence.
Let's talk about that evidence of innocence. Stanley Tukey Williams has always maintained his innocence. He was convicted of killing four people in two robberies in 1981. He was convicted, and he's always maintained that he was innocent. Can you talk a little bit about some of the facts in the case? What evidence supports his claim of innocence?
Okay. There are a number of things that have been uncovered after the trial, after the fact. So, first of all, there were fingerprints at the scene of the crime. It turns out they were not his fingerprints, and they've never been identified. At one of the scenes of the crime, there was a bloody boot print. So the murderer had boots on and stepped into the blood of the victim and left a perfect boot print. That, it turned out, was not Stan's boot print, and that was never identified. One of the crime scenes was a motel, and the murderer apparently pretended to be renting a room in the motel and started the process of filling out a guest card at the motel. And therefore, there's a handwriting sample of the murderer. He didn't finish it. He got halfway into it, and I guess that's when the robbery started. But they have a handwriting sample, and it's not Stan's handwriting, and that's never been identified. And then the most important witness for the prosecution was what was later discovered to be a jailhouse, a paid police informant that also was not known at the time of the trial. But even more importantly than that, what occurred, and they did not find this out until 20 years later, when Stan's attorneys received an unsolicited letter from a inmate who said, "This has been weighing on my mind for 20 years. You need to come see me." And this is the story he told when they saw him, and he named names. That the jailhouse informant, or the paid police informant who testified in Stan's case, was given, this guy, it turns out, was in the same tier in the local L.A. County jail as Stan and the paid police informant, so he witnessed this. It turns out that a lieutenant in the police department brought the murder file to this paid police informant cell, gave it to him, and left it overnight for him to study, came back the next day, picked it up and took it out of his cell, and then a day or so later, this guy says, "Can I see?" And he asked for this exact same police lieutenant who brought the murder file. That guy comes, and then he says, "Stanley Tookie Williams volunteered a confession to me, and how could I know all of the detail that I'm about to tell you unless the murderer had told me?" When, in fact, he's talking to the same lieutenant who had just left overnight the police file for him to study. And one of the things that Stan always said when people, his own attorneys, didn't really believe him on a certain level in terms of his innocence, when he said he didn't know where this guy got all this information, but one of the things he pointed out was this guy, as he gave explained and gave the so-called volunteer's confession of Stan, he got into great detail about the color of the sweater of one of the victims. I mean, a whole lot of detail that no man even would get into a fashion statement, you know, describing the style of the clothes and the colors. And, you know, it's not the thing that any criminal would do. But this was a guy who had too much information because he'd been allowed to study the murder file. But, of course, no one knew that until 20 years later. So that's just some. And another piece of information, there were witnesses to, at one of the crime scenes, the murderers fleeing the scene, and they identified three people and described them. And Stan is 5'10 and weighs about 265 pounds of pure muscle, and he was bigger than that back then. So, and the description were of three slightly built men, and I'm telling you, Stan is the size of a truck almost. There's no way, not in the dawn, not in the dusk, would anyone describe him as being slightly built. So that's another, and I'm still only giving you just a fraction of the evidence that has been found in recent years. You know, another witness was beaten to a pulp by the police, called a stupid, no-good nigger. His ribs were fractured, and he, 13 years later, testified that he was prepared to tell the police anything they wanted to hear about Stan to stop the worst beating he'd ever had in his life.
So Stan was convicted by testimony from jailhouse snitches and witnesses that were abused and coerced.
That's exactly right.
Was there any physical evidence used to convict Stan, or was it solely on the words of others?
Okay, the only physical evidence was that the gun that they said that one of the shells, or the shotgun that they said one of the shells came from, was, they said, came from a shotgun that Stan had purchased 5 years earlier, but that was actually not in his possession at the time, was in the possession of a husband and wife team. It was under the bed that they slept in, and they, in fact, were under investigation for murdering their crime partner, and that murder investigation of them went away when they said the gun that was under their bed was, in fact, the gun that Stan used for these crimes. The ballistics expert was initially tested and said that there was no evidence that that gun was, in fact, even the same gun that came, that produced the shell at one of the crime scenes. The district attorney went back to the ballistics expert and said, check again. He didn't accept the ballistics expert saying there was no evidence that that gun had anything to do with those crimes. When he pressured the ballistics expert to test again, the ballistics expert said in writing that, well, the after 16 shots, it was similar. There were two shells out of 16 after testing the gun 16 times that were similar. That's what he put in writing. So there you go.
And you say that Stan's fingerprints were not on this gun. Were there other fingerprints on it?
Well, that's, you know what? That's an excellent question. And guess what? They never tested the fingerprints on the gun. Isn't that interesting?
That is rather unbelievable.
But it's true. This case is just unbelievable every way you look at it. I mean, Stan was shackled throughout his trial, and that's so prejudicial to a jury that you're supposed to have a hearing where the prosecutor has to prove that there is simply no other way to have this trial without him being shackled. And, of course, no such hearing occurred. prison system, I mean, the criminal justice system, you know, it's unbelievable to me that they would not allow the shackling, as they acknowledge, so it's in the court reports that, quote, he was unjustifiably shackled. They say that. And then they go on to say, but, you know, the jury probably didn't see it, so it doesn't count. Well, you know, why wouldn't they have seen it? You know, he was shackled in his feet, his ankles, and at his wrist or at his waist. The guy whose ribs were fractured, the subhead in the Ninth Circuit ruling was illegal coercion of witness. Okay, they admit it, illegal coercion of witness. And then they say, but he was beaten up 2 years before the trial, so by the trial, he certainly wasn't still afraid of the police by 2 years later, when in fact, 13 years later, when he signed the affidavit telling what happened, his hands were shaking then. He was still afraid 13 years later. But the court said he shouldn't have been afraid 2 years later. And so, therefore, they discounted illegal coercion of witness. You know, it just goes on and on. They admit all of these bad things happen, and then they come up with, like, the finding the evidence of this of the police bringing the murder file into the cell. They don't deny that that happened. What they're saying is Stan's appellate attorneys missed a deadline in presenting that information, so they're just not going to count it because the attorneys missed the deadline.
So again,
I mean, it's just, you know,
it's more about it's more about technicalities in the system than it is about actual evidence. As you say, he was unjustifiably shackled. There was witnesses who were illegally coerced by being beaten, having their ribs fractured. There was a prosecutor who basically used unconstitutional tactics to remove black prospective jurors, and also argued during the trial, comparing Stan to a Bengal tiger in the zoo, and stating that the black community he came from, South Central LA, was equivalent to the natural, quote, habitat of a Bengal tiger.
Yet,
despite all that, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on October 11th against him on his final appeal, basically stating that these things are all fine. So what you're saying that by upholding his conviction, the U.S. Supreme Court in this ruling is establishing basically, quote, as case law for the nation, the right for prosecutors to exclude jurors on the basis of race and
that is correct.
Denigrate minority defendants in front of all white juries. Is that?
That is correct. And that is even, so, you know, you don't even have to take my legal analysis of it. That is what the Ninth Circuit, those nine judges who were so outraged by this prosecutor and the whole list of unconstitutional things that happened in Stan's case, that they said that if this ruling was allowed to stand, it would allow any prosecutor who was inclined to discriminate, it would allow him or her to do so with impunity. Those were their words. So, and she actually, they went on to also say that if this ruling was allowed to stand, it would undermine the very integrity of the criminal justice system, period, in this country. And that is exactly what it's going to do. I mean, now it's a field day. I mean, our rights have been rolled back 100 years with this ruling. In 1896, the Supreme Court had another shameful ruling, and that was the Plessy v. Ferguson ruling, which was the separate but equal ruling in terms of blacks and whites. I predict that history is going to judge this ruling as the Plessy v. Ferguson ruling of the 21st century. It is another shameful day in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court.
You're tuned to 101.1 FM Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm speaking with Barbara Becknell. She is Stanley Tukey Williams' editor and his advocate, and she is now also an anti-death penalty activist. We're speaking about Stanley Tukey Williams' case. He has been a death row inmate at San Quentin State Prison since 1981. Recently, the U.S. Supreme Court on October 11th ruled against his final appeal. His execution date has been set for December 13th. That date will be confirmed on October 24th when his attorneys go to court. They've been informed that that's the date that will be set. So, Barbara, maybe we could talk about Stanley as a person. We've talked quite a bit now about his case, about evidence of innocence, about problems with his trial, racism in the trial, and we've referred to the 9 books that he has written to educate young people about the dangers of gangs and gang violence, as well as his internet education programs. I want to hear more about some of the positive work that Stanley has done, for which he's been nominated 5 times for a Nobel Peace Prize and 4 times for the Nobel Prize in Literature. But also, can you give us an idea of what kind of person he is? You're his advocate. You, I'm sure, meet with him. So can you just tell us more about him as a human being?
Well, a good example, I just visited him today. So in talking to you, I just got back from the prison. And so here he is facing an execution date of December 13th. And really, the majority of our visit was discussing, you know, how much more can he do to help kids during the next couple of months. So he is finishing up another book, so that would be his 11th book. He also has just written his autobiography, Blue Rage, Black Redemption, a memoir. And so now he's working on a book for girl gangs, because he's received quite a few emails in recent years from girls who are members of gangs. So he wants to focus on that, so he's trying to finish that up. And he's also working on an anthology or a collection of essays dealing with the lessons that he's learned. So we're talking about that, about some messages to youth that he wants to record, some scheduling for some kids to come up and talk to him and meet with him. So he is, how to describe him? He is a very strong man with a great deal of integrity, and who is very intelligent, and who has developed over the past decade or more just a strong moral core and conscience, and wants to do whatever he can in the time he has on this planet to reverse the destructive and bloody legacy of the Crips youth gang that he co-founded some 34 years ago.
There are some folks, I'm sure, who would argue that even if Stan is innocent of the crimes for which he was convicted, that he's probably guilty of some other horrible crime, as he helped to co-found the Crips, and therefore, whether or not he's guilty of these crimes, he should go to his death. What would you say to somebody who would make an argument like that?
Well, you're right. I have certainly heard his critics say that. And where I would come out on that is, then what they're saying is that if law enforcement doesn't like me or you or anyone, or suspects us, has no proof of it, but suspects us of doing something wrong, then they should have the right to beat witnesses up, to engage in sort of racist tactics to get a person into a jury environment where the people are fairly racist and not real thrilled with minorities, so as to guarantee or a guilty verdict, that they should be able to, let the real murderer go free, and in order to create justice for someone who they suspect of doing something wrong. I'll have to say, if that becomes the okay method of ministering justice in this country, then neither you nor me, none of us will be safe. So I can't go along with, yes, he co-founded the Crips, and therefore, okay, maybe he didn't do these crimes, but he did something else, so it's okay to set him up on this thing over here. Because let me tell you one of the other consequences, and that is the gentleman who, in fact, was the original suspect for these crimes and who, in fact, was let off scot-free, even though that's who they really suspected of doing the crimes, because he was willing to say he was there, but Stan was there and made him do it. That guy did not get one day in prison. And guess what? He has killed someone else and is currently in prison elsewhere for murder. So the person, so there you go. There's no good ending to a justice system that decides it's okay to actually engage in criminal activities themselves in order to get somebody, to set somebody up because they feel they deserve it. It's their opinion that they deserve it, mm-hmm. not that there's proof that they deserve it.
How long have you known Stan?
Almost 13 years.
And you met him because you were doing some investigative work for your book about the Crips, the history mm-hmm. of the Crips. So
I did. And you should know, I never believed in the death penalty, but I was fairly naive. I'm an educated middle-class person who had no, I'd never visited a prison before in my life when I came, the first time I came to see Stan, let alone someone on death row. So I did not come to this with, number one, any intention of even working with Stan beyond getting my interview for the book that I was writing. And two, while I didn't believe in the death penalty, I naively believed in the criminal justice system. So I assumed he was guilty. And in fact, I didn't change my mind on that until maybe about 6 or 7 years ago when all of this other evidence started presenting itself, and then it was like, oh my God, this man is innocent, But I did make the decision that he had, that he was a unique inmate in that having, being a legend or an archetype himself of the street gang world, that he had influence when he was doing the wrong things in life, and my instinct was that he would have significant influence as he did good things. And in fact, that has proven to be true because he has received now, I'd say somewhere around 60,000 or more emails from young people and parents and teachers and law enforcement folks who use his work throughout from across the country and around the world. And what they say is that he saved their lives. Either they were going to join a gang and read his books or saw his movie that where Jamie Foxx played him in the movie called Redemption, the Stan Tookie Williams story, a TV movie that came out last year, and that caused them not to join a gang, or they were already in a gang and they got out. One woman wrote and said, 5 members of my family quit gangbanging after watching your movie. I mean, it's just, at least once a week I cry just based on reading these emails and knowing the tremendous impact that he's having on young people in this country and as far away as the Netherlands, New Zealand, Australia, Guatemala, Mexico, Brazil, it's just amazing. So it's, and doing this from a 4 by 9 foot cell. So it's remarkable, extraordinary work.
In September of 2002, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled against Tukey, but at the same time, they recommended that his life be spared. They recommended clemency. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that was a sort of a bittersweet day because, you know, once again, that was the ruling where they had subheads of illegal coercion of witness and where they acknowledged many of the bad things that had happened but still ruled against him. But then it was a surprisingly positive moment in that they made history because no circuit court had ever done that before, which is to then segue or sort of leave their legal analysis and move into citing. They in fact referred to Stan's work as laudable, and they said it was worthy of a governor considering him for clemency. So that had never, ever happened with a federal court, but that happened in Stan's case. So, hopefully that will mean something to our governor.
What is likely to happen at this point? Again, Stanley Tukey Williams' final appeal rejected on October 11th by the U.S. Supreme Court, ignoring issues of unconstitutional striking of black prospective jurors during his original trial, of racist comments from the prosecutor, who himself was admonished twice by the California State Supreme Court for the very same behavior in other cases. In fact, I believe a death sentence was reversed in
two other cases.
Because of this type of behavior by this very same prosecutor, the Supreme Court ignoring all of that and ruling against Tukey. Again, he has his attorneys have been told that an execution date will be set for December 13th. That will be confirmed on the 24th when they go to court. What is likely to happen from there, Barbara, and what can people do to support Tukey if they would like to do that?
Okay, so what will happen is a couple of weeks before the 13th, or maybe about a week and a half before the 13th execution date, there will be a hearing, a clemency hearing, and in Sacramento, or that's where it's likely to be. And Stan's attorneys will have witnesses who will make their case about why Stan is worth more alive than dead to society, and then the attorney general or the district attorney in L.A. will make their case as to why they feel he should be executed. Typically, you then hear back from board of, I think it's called Board of Prisons and Pardons. Well, they will make their suggestion or their recommendation to the governor. The governor will accept or reject their recommendation and typically goes public with it maybe about 3 days, 2 to 3 days before the execution date, the 13th. So that's the clemency track, what will happen. Meanwhile, in November, his attorneys are going to file a new habeas petition, a federal petition in federal court introducing new evidence. So I've just given you sort of a summary of existing evidence, but there's new evidence that I can't talk about yet that that will be introduced in this petition sometime next month. Now, meanwhile, what everyone can do to help is go to www.savetukey.org. So Save Tukey, T as in Tom, O-O-K-I-E, .org, O-R-G. And we have petitions that you can print out. We'll have sample letters to the governor up by tomorrow. So we need folks to email, fax, write, the governor and say, you know, that Stan should not be executed, given the racism and the prosecutorial misconduct, the police misconduct. It's just, as some people in the legal profession are saying, it's really a dirty case, and the public has no idea how dirty this case is. It's quite outrageous. And so no one should be executed based on the evidence, which is virtually non-existent, that they used against Stan. And then you throw in all of the unjustified shackling and the racism and the tampering with the court and the court's trial location, and then the animal jungle metaphors, and it just goes on and on and on. So we're asking people to go to that website. There's a fact sheet that gives information about the case that tells you five things you can do to help. And the first thing is go to that website and get the information.
There's another website as well that you can link to through SaveTukey.org, which is the website you're speaking about. There's another website, Tukey.com, where people... Can you describe that one?
Yes. That website also has some information about his case, but it has a great deal of information about his work. And so it has, for example, Stan created a few years ago what he calls a street peace protocol, and it really is a document that lays out a process, a step-by-step process for creating peace one block at a time, one neighborhood at a time, one city at a time. And in fact, in Newark, New Jersey, last year, the first 4 months of the year, the murder rate, gang-related murder rate, were 32 deaths based on the war between the Crips and the Bloods just in the first 4 months of last year. They then saw the movie in April, went to the website, saw the Street Peace Protocol, printed it out, and followed the instructions and literally created a truce. And 150 Crips and Bloods signed the truce document in May of last year, and the killing stopped. So it's amazing. And the truce still holds, and now, and it's been more than a year. So that's the kind of material that is on the Tukey.com website for folks who could rely on that material during the Tukey teach-in day on November 21st.
And, of course, you can obtain his books through that Tukey.com site as well, including his latest book, which is a memoir, Blue Rage, Black Redemption.
The Stan Tukey Williams, a memoir, his autobiography.
Okay. Thanks.
So they can get that there, as well as he's written 9 other books for anti-gang, anti-violence books for elementary school kids as well.
Mm-hmm. Any final thoughts today, Barbara?
Well, I just saw Stan, and he still has great faith in God and great faith that the state of California simply will not be able to do what they plan to do, which is to sort of kill him and at the same time sweep all of the corruption and racism associated with his case under the rug. That's why they're pressing to kill him so quickly. They're hoping that we won't get ourselves together to fight back. But they're sadly mistaken, because we are organized from the Millions More Movement event in Washington, D.C., where some hundreds of thousands of people were there, and I was allowed to speak about Stan's case and the racism and what has happened. And emails are coming in. By the way, the email to Stan, and I can get access to it as well, is Tukey@Tukey.com. And so the nation and the world, emails are coming in from all over the world saying they're going to protest, they're going to stand up, this is outrageous. So, you know, he has faith, and so I'm asking your listeners to let me hear from you, email me at tookie@tookie.com. Call at 510-235-9780. Ask for Crystal or Kathleen. Let us hear from you. Download those petitions and then call and make arrangements to either mail them to us so that we can put a package that is maybe 50 feet high, you know, of petitions and letters to the governor. And have the, I'm hoping we need a truck to deliver all of this to the governor when that time comes.
And I will repeat that phone number as well as the websites in just a moment. Thank you so much, Barbara, for joining me today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.
We'll talk again as the time approaches.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
And that was Barbara Becknell. She is Stanley Tookie Williams' editor and his advocate, and she is now an anti-death penalty activist. She met Williams in 1993 while researching her book, America's Other Civil War, The History of the Crips and Bloods. And during her interviews with Mr. Williams, Barbara learned of his commitment to putting an end to the violent legacy that had begun with the formation of the Crips. In 1996, they collaborated on an 8-book series. Tookie speaks out against gang violence. He's he's written a total of 11 books. At this point, he's working on his 11th book. You can get his books at the website Tookie.com. His latest book, Blue Rage, Black Redemption. It's his life story. It's an autobiography. You can also read about his case at SaveTookie.org, where you can download fact sheets. You can print those and share them. You can also download and circulate a petition to save Tookie. You can send an email at Tookie@Tookie.com is the way to send an email, Tookie@Tookie.com. There is a way to sign a petition to save Tookie on the website, SaveTookie.org. It's a petition to Governor Schwarzenegger. You can also read about the ACLU coming out on his behalf, urging the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals to consider racist injustices in jury selection during his 1981 trial. You can read about the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals recommending clemency for Tookie, among a lot of other information there at the website, SaveTookie.org. And the phone number that Barbara gave out, 510-235-9780, to speak with Crystal or Kathleen about what you can do to help. That's 510-235-9780, and ask for Crystal or Kathleen, or send an email to Tookie@Tookie.com. If you missed any of the information, go to the website, SaveTookie.org, or send an email to Tookie@Tookie.com, or give Crystal and Kathleen a call again at, finally, 510-235-9780. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, streaming online at freakradio.org.